Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 19th of November. For the first time, astronomers have taken snapshots of a multi-planet solar system. It's much like our system, and it's orbiting another star. This was news released late last week. The system orbits a dusty young star named HR 8799. It's 140 light-years away and about 1.5 times the size of our sun. The planets are 10, 10, and 7 times the mass of Jupiter, and they orbit the star. And the size of the planets decreases with distance from the parent star, much like the giant planets do in our solar system. And there may be more planets out there. Scientists say they haven't seen them yet. So how did we see this new solar system, and what does it mean for Earth, and what kind of further exploration will be going on? We'll be looking at that, and also the future of the space program. The shuttle program is supposed to retire in the year 2010, and we'll be looking at what the new administration has in mind for space exploration and what you might have in mind for space exploration. The first hour of our program, our guest, no stranger to this show, Rich Talcott, is senior editor of Astronomy Magazine, and we'll be welcoming phone calls. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send us an email, you can do that as well, and that is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Hello, Rich. Thanks so much for being with us.
Good morning.
Now, tell me about how they made this discovery. I don't fully understand. Did they get a picture of it? Did they use some computer technology? What was it?
Well, it's a combination of the two, actually. It turns out that what they used is a telescope on the top of Mauna Kea, which is on the Big Island of Hawaii. And they were looking in what's called near-infrared light, which is wavelengths just a little bit longer than what we can see with our naked eye. And that's good at detecting kind of faint objects that glow by their own heat as opposed to reflecting sunlight like our planets do. And they were able to pick out at least three planets circling this rather nondescript star otherwise. The star itself has a fairly large dusty disk, so it appears fairly bright in the longer wavelengths that they were looking at. But then they obviously had to do some computer processing because the light of the star itself is much more than the light from the planets. And so they had to use the computer to block out the light of the star so they could pick out the small planets.
Mm-hmm. And is this the first time that we have pictures of any kind of multi-planet solar system?
Yes, this is actually the first photographs that we've had of them. We've detected more than 300 planets around other stars now, so the numbers have grown significantly over the last decade. But these are the first actual pictures that we have.
Mm-hmm.
I might also add that just a day or two after this discovery was announced, the first planet imaged around a star in visible light was taken, and that was with the Hubble Space Telescope. And that was around a star that at least has a name that's a little bit nicer than HR 8799. It's a star called Fomalhaut, and it's a bright star that's in the south right now in the early evening sky. And people can go out and actually see this star. And what the Hubble astronomers did was go out and take an image of this with their visible light camera. So that was the first image we've ever had in visible light of a planet.
Uh-huh. And that one's how far away?
That one's a little bit closer than this one. It's more around 25 light years away. So still long in terms of the distances we're used to here on Earth or in the solar system, but relatively close by in our galaxy.
Mm-hmm. I think somebody wrote a report that they're just getting news that Ronald Reagan was elected president.
That's probably true, yes.
Yeah. How do they get these weird names like HR 8799? Give us something better.
Well, the problem is that at the moment we think there are probably around 200 billion stars in our galaxy.
Ooh.
And as you can imagine, it would be difficult to come up with unique names for 200 billion objects if you were actually wanted to give them all traditional names. And so what basically happens is that they use catalogs, and one of the catalogs is called HR, and so it's the 8,799th star in that catalog. But there are other catalogs that have thousands or millions of stars, and they just go, most of them tend to go by catalog names as opposed to names that we're familiar with, like Sirius or Rigel.
So when you, as senior editor of Astronomy Magazine, get the news that we have these pictures, what are your thoughts? They're probably different than my thoughts. I think it's incredible, but you think it means what?
Well, I think it's pretty cool that we are actually able to image these things. For a long time, actually, up until the early to mid-1990s, astronomers and I thought that there were lots of planets floating around in our galaxy, but we'd never seen one, never even detected one. And so when the first planets were discovered, that was very exciting. And the odd part about it was is that a lot of these planets turned out to be nothing like the planets in our solar system. And based on a sample of one, astronomers were out there thinking that you tend to find solar systems with big planets like Jupiter and Saturn fairly far away from their star, and smaller planets that are rocky closer to the sun, closer to the star. But the first planets that were discovered outside ours were really big planets like the size of Jupiter, but they were orbiting closer to the star than Mercury does to the sun. And so that kind of started scientists to realize that the universe is a little bit stranger than they had thought that it might be. I think what the recent discoveries with the photographs are showing is that it's a new technique for finding solar systems that might be a little bit more like ours. The techniques that people have used to find these planets in the past have usually been geared toward finding big planets that are fairly close to their stars, because those have more of an effect on the star and they happen over a very short period. And so you can kind of see the motion over the course of, in some cases, days, but certainly within months and a few years. Whereas in our solar system, if we happen to be out at Fomalhaut, say, looking toward our solar system, it would take a long time to find Jupiter and Saturn, because they take at least 10 years to revolve around the sun. And so it takes a long time to build up the measurements to see the effects that Jupiter, for instance, would have on our sun. Mm-hmm. And so to see the kinds of planets that we think are probably out there and systems that resemble the sun, we kind of have to use different techniques than we've been using so far. And that's one of the nice things about these images, is that they can find these bigger planets that are further away from the stars. And the implication is that there's plenty of room inside of these big planets that they found where smaller rocky planets might exist.
So there might be more planets rolling around this new solar system, this new star. We just haven't seen them yet?
It certainly is possible. Assuming, as you mentioned, these planets are up to about 10 times as big as Jupiter is. So they're putting out a fair amount of heat that can be detected and reflecting a fair amount of light. So they're relatively easy to detect. But Jupiter itself is a few hundred times bigger than Earth is. And so you can imagine if you were looking from another star system towards us, you'd see Jupiter in its light much easier than you'd be able to see Earth. And so the techniques are barely able to capture these big planets well outside of where rocky planets would be, but not sensitive enough to detect the smaller planets that might lie closer in.
Can you make any calculations as a result of seeing pictures of this new solar system that there might be how many more solar systems similar to ours, or can you not make that assumption?
I think it's probably best, as I mentioned early on, before we had discovered any planets, we thought most solar systems would tend to look like ours, and we've found that that's definitely not true. Mm-hmm. So I think there's no consensus yet as to how many there might be like ours. I think astronomers are convinced that there probably are systems similar to ours out there, where you have big planets farther out and small planets closer in, but they haven't really been able to find all the planets around some of these stars that would show that they are very similar to ours yet.
So once you get the pictures, those who have discovered this, what are they looking at now, Rich?
A lot of them are analyzing the observations a little bit more. One of the things they can do is to take a look specifically at these little planets and determine whether or what kind of elements are making up the atmospheres of these planets. We assume, since they're bigger than the size of Jupiter, that they're probably gaseous like Jupiter and Saturn are in our solar system. But they can actually, we'll take a look and see if they can detect elements in their atmospheres, determine what they're made out of, what kind of elements are going on out there. So that'll be one of the things that they'll do. And as always, people are going to be taking an advantage of looking at stars that seem similar to this one. And so they're going to be looking at stars that we know have dusty disks around them and trying to image those and see if we can see planets around some other stars as well.
It's fascinating stuff. Just a quick new topic before we take some phone calls. Let's look at the future of the space shuttle program. I guess I wasn't aware that there is a countdown underway here, and this whole program is supposed to retire in the year 2010, so we're going to have a new president, the retirement of space shuttle. What next? And what has he said about what he wants to do with space?
Mostly, Barack has said that he wants to have a strong space program, but he hasn't been terribly specific about what that is. And I think part of the reason is that he's going to let NASA develop a plan and then take a look at that and see what levels of funding may make sense for new programs, not just in terms of manned exploration, like a replacement for the shuttle would be, but also in terms of exploring the outer universe and also the solar system itself. So there's a lot of things that are currently underway and a lot of things where there are tentative plans for, and I think those are the kinds of things they're going to take a look at and see what's going to make the most sense for the dollars that we have.
Does it make sense to go back to the moon? Why would we go back to the moon? Do we need to target more distant places like Mars?
The goal is to target both of them and also an intermediate target, which are some of these asteroids that come fairly near Earth. It turns out that it's quite a bit simpler to go to some of these small objects called asteroids that orbit close enough to our planet that we can reach them fairly easily, much more easily than Mars. And so the plan right now, and of course all of these things may change with the new administration and might have even changed even with the continued administration, is that they want to go back to the moon first and establish a human presence there, kind of a permanent presence, to basically understand the logistics of living on another planet where the conditions are harsh and being able to do that for an extended period of time. So just basically get the idea down as to what it is that it's going to be required in order to be able to do this. The moon is much easier to get to, obviously, because it's only a couple days away by spaceflight, whereas to get to Mars, you're talking about a several-month trip there. You'd probably want to stay there several months and then another several months to come back. You're talking probably at least a two-year or so trip to Mars and back, and so that's going to be much more logistically difficult than going to the moon certainly was back in the 1960s, where you could get there and back in the course of a week or 10 days.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's the key thing, is that they want to go to Mars eventually, but they feel that they need to either go to the moon or to some of these near-Earth asteroids first in order to get a good idea of what's going to be involved in the longer trips.
So when you talk about a permanent presence on the moon, you mean plopping people down there for a while?
Yeah, what they want to do is to build a permanent station on the moon, probably near its south pole. And that may sound kind of weird, because if you were going to Earth, you certainly wouldn't want to plop down on the south pole as the most as the likeliest place to be. But it turns out that near the poles of the moon, there are some craters that basically receive sunlight all the time, and there are or the rims of these craters on mountains that receive sunlight all the time, and deep inside these craters, they're permanently shadowed because basically the sun never gets to shine down into them. And so many people think that there may be water ice buried at the bottom of these craters that astronauts could tap into, both for a source of water, but also as a source of fuel and also as a source of oxygen. And so being able to find water ice on the moon would be a perfect situation for them to supply themselves with needed materials. And so that's one of the reasons why they're thinking of the South Pole. Not only can they have sunlight most of the time, but they can be very near a place where perhaps there's water ice. And so that's kind of the goal that they're looking for sometime, and the timetables on these things always shift, but they're hoping perhaps within 5 to 10 years that they might be able to have a presence on the moon that would at least have a permanent settlement there, and they'd rotate astronauts in and out like they do with the space station right now.
We're going to welcome phone calls for Rich, and we'll take them right now, actually. Our number is 800-486-8655, and our guest is Rich Talcott. He's senior editor of Astronomy Magazine, published here in Wisconsin. We're looking at a couple issues. The news last week that astronomers from Canada had taken the first photos of planets outside our solar system. And we're also looking at the future of the space program. When you have a new administration, you have a change of plans for what to do in space. So we're looking at what our guest says is really kind of undefined plans in terms of the Obama administration. But we're looking at what you might want to have for a space program. Does it make sense to have a permanent presence on the moon? What do you think about this new discovery of, you know, this new solar system somewhat like ours? Last week it was those pictures were published. So we're going to take your phone calls. And we'll take them in just one moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the next hour of our program, we'll be talking with a cardiologist about this latest news concerning statins. All right, to your phone calls. Let's go first to Rick from Oshkosh. Hi, Rick.
Hello.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call. I probably should have learned this in grade school, but could you please just briefly explain the difference between what makes a star, and a planet, a planet?
Sure. And I think that's a little bit beyond grade school level, but it's not terribly difficult. Basically, what it is a star is an object that is big enough so that its interior gets hot enough that it can actually start to fuse hydrogen into helium. And that's what makes itself luminous. So a star is something that puts out light into the universe by its own process. A planet is something that orbits a star and does not have enough material in it in order to be able to generate this fusion process. And so basically what they do is they shine mostly by reflected light from the star that they tend to orbit. And the cutoff, just for interest, is about roughly 10 to 20 times, or excuse me, it's about 8% of the sun's mass is how much you need in order to be able to start fusing. So something that's less than 8% as big as the sun is not big enough to form the fusion process and become a star.
Mm-hmm. Let's go next to Mike from Appleton. Hi, Mike.
Yeah, interesting program. There have been advances with the Chinese and I guess the Indians also as far as space exploration. How far are they to us as far as technology and you know, in this, I guess you'd call it new space race? Are we leaps and bounds ahead, or are they catching up fast?
They're actually catching up reasonably fast. I think most people would consider the United States and the Russians and the Europeans. The European Space Agency has a very large program of robotic missions in the solar system, at least. Those are the three leaders in terms of what's going on. But within the last couple of years, the Chinese have launched people into orbit around Earth, and they've also sent their first mission to the moon. And just earlier this week, the Indian Space Agency has sent a probe to the moon. Now, these are fairly low-cost and missions that have gone to the moon, and they aren't anywhere near the level of complexity of actually sending a man to the moon and bringing them back. But they are doing quite a bit in terms of going out, taking a look at certain elements on the moon, taking photographs, basically trying to fill in a lot of the gaps in our knowledge of the moon that still remained after the Apollo missions of the 60s and 70s. And I might mention also that the Japanese have a fairly large program. They haven't sent any humans into space yet, but they have been able to send probes to the moon, and they've also sent probes to an asteroid. So they've been quite popular, too, in terms of going out there and looking at the solar system.
We've seen some international cooperation on space endeavors. Wouldn't it make sense to really pool the resources of all of the countries in the world who are working on space programs so we can go farther, faster, and sort of share the more deeply what we find?
That's certainly a goal that a lot of people have, and I think it's a viable one as well. I mentioned the European Space Agency. There's more than a dozen European countries involved in that, so they all pooled their resources into one large program. And it it should be noted that a lot of these missions being sent up, even the Indian mission to the moon and some of the Japanese missions, they'll often include instruments that were built by scientists elsewhere. So the Americans have instruments, for instance, cameras or spectrometers that measure the abundance of elements on various places. They'll have those instruments on board missions of another country. In fact, the current mission that's at Saturn, called the Cassini mission, is a joint NASA and European mission where NASA basically built the large spacecraft and the Europeans built a smaller spacecraft that landed on the moon Titan at the right after Cassini arrived at the planet a few years back. So there is a lot of international cooperation going on. So far, I've heard talk about how it would be nice to pool resources for some of the human missions that might go out into the solar system later on. But I think that's something where countries are holding it a little bit closer to their vest and looking at doing it on an individual basis and then asking for help from others as time goes on.
Couple lines open for you now. Rich Talcott is our guest, senior editor of Astronomy Magazine. 800-486-8655 is our number. And we go to Edward from Lake Geneva next. Hi, Edward.
Oh, hi. How are you? Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I appreciate it. I need to ask a quick question to your guest. A very nice program. In given the actual distances in space, for example, from Earth to Alpha Centauri is 3.5 light years. And obviously humans cannot possibly physically travel that distance, not, you know, in any conceivable time. What are the benefits of spending billions of dollars? I'm looking at this from the taxpayer point of view. What are the real benefits to us, other than knowledge? Obviously, knowledge is very important. When we more than likely will never get anywhere else because of our restrictions that we cannot physically travel at the speed of light because we'll become pure energy and then we wouldn't exist. So what are the benefits in the far run on that? And I'll take my
answer. All right. Off the interesting air. Question. Thank you.
Well, yeah, that is an interesting question. I would say that you're right that the idea of going to stars, the nearest star is Alpha Centauri, and that's a little bit more than 4 light years away from Earth, and that would, to put that into miles, that's something like 25 trillion miles, and the moon is a few hundred thousand miles away, just to give some perspective there. It would take, even traveling far faster than we're able to do now, it would take thousands or millions of years to get there. So that's certainly out of the realm of possibility for the foreseeable future, although I guess if you looked back 200 years and we hadn't even flown an airplane yet, going out into the solar system with robotic spacecraft might seem a little bit science fiction-y as well. But personally, and I think in most senses, NASA and the other space programs around the world are not really even thinking about going beyond our solar system. They basically want to find out as much as they can about our solar system. And a lot of that is so, obviously, as the caller said, was to try to get a exploration out there to try to learn as much as we possibly can. But a lot of that also comes back to taking a look at what Earth is and trying to figure out lots of things about Earth that you can often study better by looking at other places because you see differences in what things may happen. A good example of that is that global warming that's taking place here on Earth, a lot of what we know about that was brought to the fore by studies of Venus, which has a massive greenhouse effect that raises the surface temperature there to several hundred degrees, even though it's only about 30% closer to the sun than we are. And so observations of other planets allow us to take a look at Earth that might have been or might be and try to get some knowledge of what Earth itself is doing. And I think that's one of the key things that's driving NASA and the other space agencies is not just the increase in knowledge, but also how we can relate that to Earth and our future.
Mm-hmm. Going back to this newest snapshot of the other solar system, where are the best places to see HR 8799?
That's actually not the easiest one to see because it's not a super bright star. It's in the constellation Pegasus, which is actually out at the and at evenings at this time of year. In fact, it's fairly high in the sky. The easy way to find it is you may be familiar with the Great Square of Pegasus, but there are four reasonably bright stars in the shape of a square that lie high in the south say around 7 o'clock in the evening right now, and the star is in that constellation. But I might mention, too, the other one where they took the image called Fomalhaut is also in the southern sky at this time of year, and you can find it basically by taking the stars of Pegasus and looking directly south from there, in other words, underneath it, and you'll get the bright star that you see between Pegasus and the horizon is Fomalhaut. And so you can actually go out and see that one fairly easily on nights around this time of year.
And what about the pictures, Rich?
The pictures, they're available on astronomy.com, our website.
Okay.
And they're also available on the site of the Gemini Observatory, which is the one that took the image. And the ones of Fomalhaut are on the Hubble Space Telescope website.
Okay. Let's go next to Dave from Green Bay. Hi, Dave.
Hi. Just some comments about the coordination of our U.S. efforts to work with other nations. In 2007, there was a global space exploration agreement that was signed by 14 nations, and that was in an intent to coordinate the international resources to explore outer space. More recently, earlier this year, there was an International Lunar Network Agreement, which is an agreement to coordinate and to develop a network of landers on the moon. These would create a geophysical science network to create heat probes for the interior lunar interior, seismometers to measure impacts on the moon or moonquakes. We're aware that there are moonquakes, and that builds on some of the work that was done in Apollo. There has been an architecture study between NASA and the European Space Agency. And the Europeans are now planning to develop a lunar cargo lander, which would put about 1.5 tons on the moon, and that could help support the delivery of supplies and materials to a lunar outpost, just like we deliver supplies to the space station. And the Europeans just demonstrated earlier this year a system that they use their own rockets to deliver supplies to the space station. The Japanese also have a similar delivery system, and now that their Japanese lab is and needed, they will also be able to coordinate their efforts in delivering materials to the Japanese lab on the International Space Station. So this has not gotten a lot of press. It's kind of low-key.
Yes.
But behind the scenes, NASA has really done an outstanding job of trying to work with other countries and to do this rationally. So even though the Bush administration has gotten a lot of hits about being unilateralist and not coordinating with other people, I think NASA is kind of a shining star. You know, they have really done a good job doing this, and I think that's a great opportunity for the Obama administration is to say, look, you know, how can we work together and do that in a very visible way? So I'm encouraged, and I think that there's a lot of good things happening that really haven't risen to public attention, and I think there's more to come.
Thank you, Richard. Rich.
Yes, I would definitely agree with what you had to say. It's very interesting that the kinds of international cooperation that go on do tend to be a little bit below the radar screens of most people. And that may well just be because of chauvinism on the parts of the countries involved. Obviously, if NASA is the chief entity behind a certain space mission, they're going to be the ones doing the most press on it. And likewise with the Europeans, they're going to be the ones that talk mostly about what their instruments are doing. And so there does tend to be that kind of, this is their mission, this is our mission, this is the third person's mission, and not give the credit overall where there's lots of people usually involved in these missions, even in some cases with the fueling systems and things like that, so not the science instruments, but you'll be able to get transportation needs met by one country's space program that gets integrated into another country's probe. So that is going on quite a lot. I have a feeling that if plans for going back to the moon and onto Mars actually move forward over the next decade or so, that we're going to have to see more international cooperation in terms of the human presence up there. But at the moment, I think that's probably the area where there's the least cooperation. I think you tend to see it much more with the smaller missions that are going on.
I must ask you this. I know it's a question everybody asks, but all my life I've always thought that we would be discovering some form of life that thinks somewhere during my lifetime. And now I'm getting pretty old and I'm not sure it's going to happen. But I've always thought that it would just make this Earth change in some ways. I don't even know how it would change. What are the possibilities of that happening still? Is it just it's so far away and it's so hard to get there, and it would be hard for if there's anybody out there to get to us, that that's just silly to think that, Rich, or not?
I wouldn't go as far as calling it silly.
Okay.
I would say that I think it would be incredibly lucky if we happened to meet, as you were saying, thinking creatures out there, because that requires communications and how the communications work across these interstellar distances. Obviously, radio waves and those kinds of things can travel back and forth, but depending on how far away they are, the conversation can last decades or longer. And we haven't received any firm indications that there's anybody out there broadcasting in our direction. So I think that would have to be lucky. We'd almost have to luck upon seeing another civilization out there that's broadcasting something. And as far as just being able, just being thinking beings, I mean, if you think about humans back several thousand years ago, they didn't have any way to communicate off of our planet. And so there may be thinking beings out there that we just have no way of finding out about. But the interesting thing is that scientists are looking for life elsewhere in the universe. Obviously, there are some fairly sophisticated experiments going on to try to find evidence on Mars, for instance, that there might have been life there at one point. And there are some other objects in the solar system that scientists are at least cautiously optimistic that life might have gotten started on. But that would be very primitive life. But they are looking toward other solar systems, perhaps, as being abodes, and how they would be able to go about and find, say, planets that have a lot of vegetation on them. One thing that it's kind of interesting to remember, life on Earth was very simple for a very long period of time, and it was only back, say, within the last billion years or so, that a lot of complexity grew up on life on Earth. For a long period of time, there may have been life on a planet that would be able to be detected by, say, photosynthesis or whatever, and the products that they give, that organisms give off, even though they may not be thinking at all. And so a lot of scientists are actually taking a look at what would we look for on planets to say there's something on there that's giving off elements that you would not see in a planet's atmosphere that did not have life. And so that is ongoing, and I think the odds of that bearing fruit sometime within our lifetimes is not far-fetched. I wouldn't be surprised if that happens. I wouldn't be surprised if it doesn't either. But I think that's probably the place that we'd be most likely to find life elsewhere.
Can you imagine being able to secure an interview and put the whatever it is, person or whatever, the being on the cover of Astronomy magazine?
That would be pretty cool.
That'd be cool.
Yes.
That'd be cool.
Yeah, we'll work on that one.
All right. Let's go. Is this Richard from Madison?
Hi.
Hi.
I have a question. I'm really curious how these discoveries are made. Are you just looking out in the vastness of space and come across something, or is there some systematic way to search different areas, and once you've been to one, you move on to another, or
Yeah, that's a good question.
It's a combination of both. I think in terms of the new planets that were imaged, they had a good idea of where they wanted to go because they knew this star had a dusty disk around it, and scientists think planets, and including the ones in our system, form out of dusty disks around stars early in their history. So they go and take a look at objects that have the kind of characteristics that they think might show what they're looking for. And I think that's fairly common. So there is some sort of systematic method to going about and looking at certain kinds of objects that they think might have the right qualities to be what they're looking for.
Mm-hmm. But a lot of it seems like it's just luck of the draw in terms of coming upon something that actually bears out looking further, or?
Sure, you could look at 100 stars of one type until you find what it is that you're looking for. So that there is certainly a large amount of luck there. And as I mentioned, there are a couple hundred billion stars in our galaxy. It would take a long time to be able to observe each and every one of those. And so you've got to kind of be lucky and take a narrow class of object that you're looking at and cut down way down from the total numbers that are out there. And so some of it's going to be luck and able to be able to find it. The same thing goes with the search for planets that astronomers have been making for the last decade or decade and a half now. And that's basically they target certain kinds of stars where they expect that they're going to be better able to see the motions that these planets induce in their stars. So they're doing a fairly wide survey, but only of certain kinds of stars. And so that's, and they've found stars around a good percentage of those stars. Or they found planets around a good percentage of those stars, but certainly not everyone that they've looked at.
Thanks. This is a pretty big neighborhood.
I guess so. Thanks very much for the call. Let me have you respond to this quote that was in one of the papers responding to this snapshot discovery of this other solar system. The fact that these people found their triple planet system after looking at just a few stars would seem to imply that either they are incredibly lucky or that these systems are relatively commonplace. What do you think, Rich?
I think there's a good chance that these are commonplace, in the sense that if you do have a dusty disk around a star, those dusty particles are going to eventually start running into each other and growing larger and larger. So I think the process by which planets form, once you do have a dusty disk surrounding the star, is probably fairly high, unless there's something really weird about the star. I might mention, too, we've mentioned possibility of life and things like that. Certainly, the systems that have been found around these two stars we've talked about mostly today are much too young for life to have formed on any of these planets. And it's probably unlikely that they'd ever get to the stage where there'd be intelligent life, because the stars are somewhat larger than the sun is, and because of that, they won't live as long as the sun has. And it's taken us 4.5 billion years to get to our stage. These stars may not last that long.
Let's welcome more phone calls in a moment. Rich Talcott is our guest, senior editor of Astronomy Magazine. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Thanks, Richard, very much for your call. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program today, we'll be speaking with a professor of health research and policy and medicine at Stanford University about that study that has and continues to receive so much attention. And we'll ask the question, should healthy people be taking statins to, even if you have low cholesterol, it will help your heart to take that. We'll talk about that, our number two. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. Rich Talcott is our guest this hour, senior editor of Astronomy Magazine. And we go to Joan from Dodge County. Hi, Joan.
Hi, good morning.
Hi.
I would like to ask your guest there, has he heard of the planet Kolob?
The planet what?
Kolob, K-O-L-O-B.
I can't say that sounds familiar to me.
It isn't? How about Ole?
No, that doesn't sound familiar either.
Okay, all right. You probably wouldn't. Do you know why? Because you'd have to be reading the Book of Mormon to discover this. And the reason you are interested in the stars and the moon, which is understood completely, because God said that we would be. But they are there, and they are set for a reason.
All right. Thanks very much, Joan, for the call. Let's go to John from Madison. Hi, John.
Yeah, hi. How are you this morning?
Fine. How are you?
I think it's a very welcome show with the political box that we've all found ourselves sequestered in for the last few years. Very refreshing.
Okay. Sure.
My question is regarding the space ladder. It's really two-part question. Is such a thing feasible to pull loads into space? I've read a lot about it over the last couple of years, but nothing really recent. And number two, couldn't we use that infrastructure to alleviate or exhaust our carbon problem that we've found ourselves in, i.e. global warming?
That's an interesting point. I'm not probably the best person to talk about this, but my understanding is that space ladders are among the many different ways that people are taking a look at being able to access near-Earth space. And my guess is that, as with lots of other things, this is probably one of those ideas that in theory works, but it may just take so much money to try to get a viable system functioning that it's probably not something that's going to be happening anytime in the foreseeable future anyway. About whether it might be a way of getting some carbon off of Earth, that is certainly is an interesting idea that I hadn't really heard before. And it would be interesting to see if they might be able to, if that does work out, maybe there'll be more funding that goes into this so that they could take a look at possibly doing that.
I made it up myself. You can use it. Hey, if somebody can use it and make it work, more power to us, right?
Sure.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thanks, John.
Bye now.
Bye. Let's go to Paul from La Crosse next. Hi, Paul.
Hi. Hubble has sort of fallen off the map again. I know there was a rescue mission planned like this year or next year and haven't heard much about it. And there's also a new class of, a few years ago they were talking about just discarding it, letting its orbit decay and burn up. But there's now a whole new class of telescopes around the Earth that make the images from Hubble obsolete. And so I was wondering, is there still an interest in saving Hubble? And if they do save it, which I'd kind of like to see myself, is it still relevant to space exploration?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. One of the reasons you probably haven't heard as much from Hubble recently is that it's an old observatory. It was launched back in 1990, and a lot of its components have started to give out. It turns out that its main camera right now is only functioning on one channel, and unfortunately it's not the channel that takes the pretty pictures that we're all used to seeing. And so it's going back to a camera that's been on board for more than 15 years now. So it's using fairly old technology at the moment and having problems with some of its instruments. That's what the purpose of the servicing mission you discussed was. And originally that was planned actually for last month. But then there was a electrical problem on the space telescope that caused them to want to reevaluate what it was they were going to do when they got up there. Obviously, if there was a major failure taking a servicing mission up there and replacing instruments and then having the electronics still not working properly wouldn't be very cost-effective. So they've delayed the mission till next spring. My feeling is that they definitely are going to do the mission unless something very strange happens. They will replace two instruments that are fairly old right now with new and much better instruments. They're going to repair two of the instruments that are not functioning properly right now. And so presumably by this time next year, the space telescope will be back and operating essentially at peak efficiency as it has for most of the last 15 years. So that's the good news. The other point that you make is how long is it going to be worth keeping up there? I think because we can service it and put in new instruments, the instruments are basically up-to-date technologically, as much as being able to send another spacecraft totally separate from Hubble up there because they've been developed over the last couple of years as opposed to a decade or more ago. So the new instruments they're putting on there will make Hubble basically a state-of-the-art instrument once again. And I think that's the key thing there. I don't believe there are any, in fact, I'm sure there aren't any spacecraft up there right now taking photos and doing other observations as good as Hubble can do in visible light anyway. There are several other observatories up there that can observe X-rays and observe infrared light, and they're doing making incredible pictures as well, but they're different kinds of images. I think Hubble is probably going to stay up there on at least for another 4 or 5 years, at which point there'll be another improved version of Hubble called the James Webb Space Telescope. That's going to go up and be much bigger and presumably do a lot more than Hubble's capable of now.
Anything else, Paul?
No, thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call. And we go to Ezra next from Appleton. Hi, Ezra.
Hi, thank you guys so much for the show.
Uh-huh.
I'm a young astronomer, so these questions are coming from not much knowledge, but I definitely wanted to just kind of throw at you the question that I'm going to try to make a question out of it. We have about 100 years of shooting instruments into space, and we have about 1,000 years of just enjoying looking up at the sky and noticing rotations of things and setting up even things so beautiful as the calendar that we still use to this day. You see what I mean? Just by the rotation of the planets around the sun and all this. So I think it's fantastic that we're able to go just, you know, so much further and still be able to predict certain things from happening. And I wonder to myself, and I wonder just to the public out there too, what responsibility the people who are now making predictions for us in our name, since we are all now just kind of going about our lives and we're not involved in all of the star studying and all this thing, these things going on. What responsibility you think that the folks that are in control of all those things have to the public to let us know when there's events happening, large events, things that could affect us in a long-term kind of thing? I mean, just, I guess, trying to make a question out of it to you. What do you think is the responsibility? And if do they have a responsibility, you know, how far does it go?
Okay, Rich?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. I think that they do, most astronomers and scientists in general, do feel a fairly large responsibility toward the general public. A lot of that, I think, comes from the fact that a lot of the funding for research now comes either from the federal government or from state governments or from universities that get their funding from people that, if they at least don't demand results, they at least strongly encourage people to go out there and release their findings. And so I think a couple of hundred years ago, certainly, there was much more of the lone scientist keeping his knowledge to himself. I think right now, the way things are set up, and in fact, I think the general mindset of most scientists is that they want to get the information out there. They want people to know what it is they're working on and what effects that may have. Certainly, one thing that came to mind when you were talking was the search for asteroids that may possibly be on a collision course with Earth. And that's something that astronomers have been working on fairly strongly for the last decade or so, is to try to catalog as many of these objects out there that may one day impact Earth. We know that they've done so in the distant past, and we know that they'll do so in the future. And the question is, will we be able to find out when it's going to happen and once we do, what we can do about it? And I think the scientists involved are very transparent in what they're doing, and that they're going to be telling us as soon as they know anything that might be on a possible collision course.
And what can we do about it?
Well, that's the question. We've reached the technological stage where we can find these objects and probably find most of the ones that would be big enough to do severe damage to Earth. We haven't really decided what we might do when that happens. There are lots of theories out there, but nobody's come up with this is the best thing to do. One possibility would be to set off an explosion, say, near where the object is. It's not the case of blowing up a big rock or anything like that, but just being able to nudge it so that its orbit takes it away from Earth. Turns out you don't need to impart very much energy to an object when it's far away from us to change its orbit slightly, and a slight change in its orbit can send it very far away from where we are. And so most of the tactics are taking a look at ways in which they can just gently nudge an object that may be on a collision course onto another orbit that would totally miss Earth.
That would be a good idea.
Yes.
Yes. Thanks, Ezra, for your call. Tony from Juneau. Hi, Tony.
Hi there. Hey, I love astronomy, and I'd like to know where I can get more astronomy info, especially maybe hearing astronomers such as yourself speak or share ideas.
Well, I think a good way to get the information certainly is to log on to the web. Our website, astronomy.com, has a whole lot of information on there and keeps up to date with the latest news that's going on. But so do a lot of other websites. The Hubble Space Telescope website is very good in terms of having great images as well as the science that the spacecraft is doing. I mentioned Hubble is not functioning too well right now, but there's so many observations from the past 15 years that it has taken that scientists are still working on all that data, and so they keep coming out with new discoveries based on the observations that they've made. So I think those are two good sources for the latest news as far as astronomy goes. In terms of hearing astronomers talk, that's the kind of thing where if something's happening in our area, you'll usually find out about it in the local newspapers, and certainly astronomy NASA.com talks about famous astronomers that may be coming to the area where they might be doing public lectures.
Mm-hmm. Thanks very much for the call. Oh, Rich, I love talking to you. I just get carried off into another world. It's so interesting. It's just so interesting.
I'm glad.
Thanks. Thanks for being with us.
Sure, you're welcome.
Rich Talkett, our guest, senior editor of Astronomy Magazine. And again, they do have published the first snapshots of this other solar system where we started our conversation this hour, HR 89's. I'm sorry, 80, they need a new name, HR 8799, with its planets in a solar system that's somewhat similar to ours. So you can find that on astronomy.com. And also, as he suggested, Google Hubble, and you can get some astounding pictures. Thank you to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, to Mimi Notstein for on-air production here in our Milwaukee studios, and thanks, as always, for your wonderful phone calls and your curiosity about this issue. We have news coming up momentarily from National Public Radio, and then we will return with more conversation on this Wednesday morning, talking about your heart and that major study that was released on statins, or all kinds of people rushing to get prescriptions filled, even if they have normal cholesterol. Is that a good thing? We'll be talking about that. So please stay tuned. I'm Kathleen Dunn. It's a minute before 10 on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.